Interim Committee on Healthcare and Human Services and Rural Health Policy. Next on our agenda is the Department of Human Services.
Right.
And we're going to start with the DHS modernization. And with that, Tricia Baxter and Trina Lee, please come forward.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Trina Lee, and I'm the Modernization Director for DHS.
And I'm Tricia Baxter. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Aging and Disability Programs at the Department of Human Services.
Great. Madam Chair, Mona Sanderson, I really appreciate this opportunity to bring a little bit of information around DHS modernization to this committee. I'm truly honored to be here. This is a first for me because I am new to this position for a couple months, but I'm not new to DHS. The past 22 years, I've actually been a district manager over in Eastern Oregon for aging and people with disabilities. So thank you again for this opportunity. I would like to briefly describe and kind of set the scenario of kind of what modernization is for DHS. I'm going to talk a little bit about our goals, our service delivery, technology, and results for the client. I do want to leave a little bit of time for some questions, and I know that there's some other presentations behind, so I will try to keep it brief. First and foremost, DHS modernization is more than just an IT project. In the recent past, modernization was merely defined as an IT project to replace a Medicaid and SNAP application. And at the same time, there was some efforts being made also to create the health insurance exchange. In that process of determining the as-is state, we really determined that we have an opportunity to make some changes in a lot of different areas. For example, our infrastructure, our service delivery models. However, if we just simply focus upon having a new electronic application, we're not going to really solve the true problems. We're just going to be in yet another patchwork quilt, and we're not going to be having an opportunity to really look at things holistically. As many people are aware, DHS is reliant upon very outdated legacy computer systems to deliver services. And by just adding yet another piece to complexity, this is not going to give us the functionality that we need. The legacy systems are extremely fragile. They're not sustainable. As you are maybe aware, the demand for our services and human services is are at the utmost high. When our resources and understaffing is also an issue. This has kind of created what I consider the perfect storm. However, I look at it from my perspective almost as the perfect opportunity. We have opportunity to exist to make significant changes to move toward efficiencies and reinvestments. We have the opportunity to change the client experience and maximize the administration of our programs. I'm going to talk just a little bit about service delivery. Our partner agencies and DHS, we're committed to changing the customer experience. We'd like to create opportunities for the client to access our service in a more customized way and allow the clients that we serve additional time with their case managers. We are starting with automated eligibility for Medicaid, SNAP, TANF, and ERDC. But once that's accomplished, we would like to roll it out to our other programs. This added option to apply for benefits is not going to completely replace the way that folks walk into our office, but merely it'll give them yet another selection. We know we do not have all the answers right now, but we are striving to surface them. We know that our service delivery and the client experience will change. It has to change. The technology component of modernization will result in new and innovative and more efficient technology systems that will streamline operations in our field offices, giving workers more time with clients and community partners, and allowing them less time on paperwork and processes. Data interoperability will improve service coordination across programs and service systems. We are looking at mobile and adaptable technology and solutions. One example of the biggest difference is building a capacity within our own staff. We will be able to make significant changes, for example, our standards for our programs, in a more user-friendly and efficient manner, rather than using outdated code. Finally, I'd like to focus a little bit upon the results for our consumers or our clients. DHS modernization efforts will create better access to our programs and improve timeliness so we can reinvest and have more time with the case manager, which we feel is the most bang for our buck and yours. It is our belief that more time with case managers will help them on their journey to self-sufficiency and independence. If a client has a current need, currently they have to wait until normal business hours in order to meet that need. I would like to see, and I know the department would too, for us to be accessible, at least to a certain extent, at their greatest time of need, which may not be between 8 to 5 Monday through Friday. Realistically, are we going to have a 24/7 system? No, but we'll have something in the middle of that. This process, and we want them to be able to get started on whatever application benefits that they might be eligible for and that they will need to apply for. A few real key takeaways, and then I will move on to some questions. Modernization is more than just an IT project. It's an opportunity to change our current human services systems, service delivery, and the client experience. It's an opportunity to streamline processes and programs so that the focus can be on case management. Modernization is an iterative process that is aimed to respond to the enterprise's movements with agility, flexibility, as we face the challenges of tomorrow. I want to thank you, Madam Chair Mona Sanderson, and members of the committee for this opportunity. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions?
Thank you very much. No, you're just here for moral support. All right.
Thank you.
All right. We are moving the Developmental Disabilities Program sustainability. We talked with Tricia Baxter and Mike Mealy to December because we're just running out of time and we need to be out of here by 11. So we'll go on to the child welfare transformation. How much time? Lois Day and Jerry Weybrandt. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for the record. My name is Lois Day. I'm the Director of Child Welfare Programs within the Department of Human Services.
And I'm Jerry Weybrandt, the Chief Operations Officer for Child Welfare and Self-Sufficiency.
Chair Mons Anderson and committee, we can be quite short. I think you have a PowerPoint, a number of the slides you've seen before, and I certainly don't have to go through all of those in detail. What I want to highlight is that the first slide talks about the impact of maltreatment throughout the life of a child, and really our focus is on earlier intervention and more effective intervention with families to mitigate the accumulated trauma children experience when they come into the foster care system. I believe you all are familiar with our strategic efforts to safely and equitably reduce the number of children who have a foster care experience and are involved in our system, and providing for those children's needs who do come into the system in a way that they leave at least as healthy, if not healthier, than when they entered the system. What I would like, there's some of our data here that I'll just offer you all, and our system continues to be driven by primarily neglect and threat of harm of neglect. That's the majority of the families that are coming to our attention who are receiving founded allegations of abuse. And poverty indicators really are the primary stressors of those families. So there's a combination there that really, as we've looked at our system over time, has compelled us to think about our interventions and the way how effective those are with these families. What I would like to talk about just for a moment is the piece that I consider the transformational piece, which is a combination of our efforts to implement what's called differential response, and I think we spoke about this at the last session, in combination with the legislation you all offered us around, it was Senate Bill 964, it's strengthening, preserving, and reunifying families programs, and I imagine you're all very familiar with it. The combination of those two allows us to adjust our response to families at that point of contact, involve community resources, and push them into a service array that is broad enough to provide for all the things that are challenging them and allows them to stay long enough to address those, providing for a stronger connection back into the community. So our hope is that as we move forward with our design and implementation of differential response and continue the implementation of strengthening, preserving, and reunifying families programs, that this will give us the tools we need to actually have an effective reduction of the number of children that enter our system. And that's sort of the crux of this 10 minutes that we were going to take. And if you all have any questions or want to talk about any kind of detail in that, I'm happy to do that.
Senator Shields, on your committee yesterday, could you explain a little bit, because we feel we need more time with human services issues, but we've been so overwhelmed with our health policy transformation and exchange that we're developing a new subset has been formed. Can you just explain a little bit about that?
Yes, Madam Chair. Senator Cruz, who's been working on these issues for a very long time, and I have been appointed by the Senate President to be part of the Task Force on Foster Youth, and Lois did a great job presenting some of the advances that have been made in system-wide, and a big focus so far has been on making sure that foster youth from Oregon Foster Youth Connect have their voices heard, and they've got some common sense approaches that there seem to be almost a uniform agreement should move forward. So that task force being chaired by Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward is moving forward, and I think we'll have some great work to do both on the budget side as well as the policy side come January.
Great. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you.
Senator Biggs?
Madam Chair, first the question, is today the day you signed the contract with Christie for Multnomah County?
Chairman Anderson, Senator Cruz, I couldn't tell you if today is the day. I can tell you that we have a contract
Or tomorrow. I mean, something like that.
Yes, we're very close.
It's and I'm hoping that effort, as well as the effort going on in Jackson County that's been ongoing, it will help inform a lot of the innovations we're looking at. And as I said yesterday, what Senator Shields talked about is absolutely true about foster care, kids having access to the records and different things like that. I think there's some very positive things we could do. But as I said yesterday, my main focus right now is to do everything we can to keep kids out of the foster care system. And in fact, Jerry and I had a conversation this morning, and we'll continue. And so there will probably be some legislation coming forward on further definition of the term founded and maybe some assessment tools. So I think that this task force will probably, Senator Shields, correct me if I'm wrong, we will probably be scheduled in between legislative days for another meeting.
Possibly, yeah.
So, and I would welcome the other members of the committee if you want to sit in. That would be absolutely wonderful. I'm also recommending that House members sit in as well, the people that have been working on these issues for a long time, so we aren't doing anything in isolation. Pardon me? Representative Krieger sat in on the task force yesterday, and you all know Wayne's been heavily involved in this issue for a decade, so we just need to make sure, I mean, the chair's right, DHS has kind of taken a second seat over the last couple of years with all the transformation and we're doing, and it's time that we refocused.
Senator Bates.
Yeah, I was. I'll be honest about this. I was stunned that there was a task force set up yesterday, and those of us who have been working on this for 4 years didn't know a thing about it, so I'll just be honest about it. I was absolutely stunned. The problem with foster care has not been a second-tier item for many of us in Ways and Means. It's been a first-tier item. And Senate Bill 964 was as transformational in this as CCOs are in health care. And so I'm just want to make sure this doesn't, nothing gets lost as we start going through this. There are issues still out there. Obviously, 964 did not solve those, but it's starting a cultural change inside the system with county commissioners and judges and the people who provide the care. The program started in Jackson County, which is now in three or four other counties and just getting started, has cut foster care roles by 50%. 50%. No other program's done something like that. The Intercept program by Christie Care can do the same thing. And they focus a little more on the older kids inside the system and helping them get out of the system and into a safe environment. There's still a big issue about the difference from county to county and what are founded cases and how those founded cases are handled. It often is more a result of the individual involved and the history in that county. Mm-hmm. If you look at what's happened in Lane County because of one terrible case, the number of founded cases there are skyrocketing because everyone's scared to death. Mm-hmm. And so those kind of issues have to be dealt with. I'm a little concerned that we don't do, and I'll borrow your phrase of isolation. And isolation is already occurring here, and it needs to be brought into one area.
Let me explain how this started.
I know how it started, okay? But you can explain more to me. But my big concern is we don't lose the initiative we started, that the task force picks that initiative and runs with it. That would be the best outcome we could have. And please feel free to
Senator Shields came and said that there are some foster care issues that he's extremely interested in, and then there was Senator Steiner Hayward, who also has experience in the foster care system. And so President Courtney, we took this to President Courtney and asked him if there could be a group that would just start being able to spend some more time on this issue, because we are so overwhelmed with taking care of our transformation issues. And so I told the president regarding our Senator Farioli, Senator Cruz, myself, and Representative Krieger have been working on some case reviews over the last period, 2 years. And so then the president came forward with appointing this group that can maybe do some preliminary work in covering the issues that are really at the top of almost every one of us's minds. So that's to give a little background on how this other group formed. Any other comments?
No. I'm just collateral damage in the whole thing.
Yes.
Excuse me, Chair Martha Anderson and committee. I wanted to just comment a little bit on the two programs that have been mentioned by the committee, and some of the common pieces of them that I think we're seeing are really helpful across the state. Both those programs provide a broad array of services. It's not one service, but a constellation of services. So families are enveloped in those programs, and that has been mm-hmm. important, and that's really a critical piece of how the legislation was written and what we were given to work with. I think the other piece that's been very important that speaks to what Senator Bates was referencing is that these programs are identified through a collaborative conversation within the county or community in which they're working. And so there's a very, I think, important connection between the state entities, the local entities, and the private community in identifying the needs of families in their community. It creates the opportunity for the community to then sort of re-enfranchise these families once they've addressed their issues. So it's very important legislation in terms of the child welfare system moving forward. And just for a brief update, we have 7 sites in which we're working on the implementation of 964, the Strengthening, Preserving, and Reunifying Families programs. The 3 original sites, Jackson County, Malheur County, and Clackamas County, which are much further along than the additional 4, which are Coos County, Josephine County, Umatilla County, and then the Alberta branch in Multnomah County. So it's a broad array of sites that are rural and urban. Some have different communities that play in them, and they're giving us some excellent information around what we need to look for in terms of rolling that out to a fuller implementation in the coming biennium.
Great.
I'm just hoping that someday it won't be the differential response, it'll be the response.
Okay. Thank you very much. With that, Michael Mason and Jackie Mercer to give us a brief presentation from the Native American Rehabilitation Association.
Thank you, Chair Mona Anderson and members of the Senate Healthcare Human Services and Rural Health Policy Committee. My name is Michael Mason. I'm here to represent the Native American Rehabilitation Association of the Northwest, which has several important facilities in the Portland metro area, serving urban Indians, actually serving Indians from all around Oregon and Southwest Washington, part with a variety of funding sources. They're best known, I think, for their urban Indian health clinic in North Portland and the A&D residential facility up near Savi Island. But they also have some important youth and family programs. As you were just handed some numbers regarding foster placement of Native American youth, and it is very high, is far higher, and has been for many years, than the numbers of people in the state would indicate. So so I just wanted to say one more thing, and that's that my tribal clients deeply respect, I would say almost revere, the work of NARA, and appreciate this opportunity for the Executive Director, Jackie Mercer, and Ms. Bruno to tell you about the programs that they have. Thank you. She did make it.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's great to see you and members of the committee. It's an honor to be here and to present. I appreciate your time, and so I know that you guys are sort of running a little behind, but I know that's what you do. So.
The main thing we do is run behind.
Yeah. I kind of resemble that remark. So. Anyway, it's great to be here again and talk with you all. We just pass out some information to you and a coin, one of our sobriety coins that we give out at New Year's Eve and for graduation for our clients. It's sort of a, you know, it's a token that people carry to remind themselves of their own strength and resiliency. And I think that's the story of NARA. And the history of NARA, you know, starts out with 1970 when NARA was born. A few decades before me.
State your name.
Oh, my gosh. I'm Jackie Mercer. I'm the CEO of the Native American Rehabilitation Association. I'm sorry. So in 1970, NARA was born and began as an alcohol and drug treatment program, opened some residential programs, and in the 1980s, NARA was the first women and children's treatment program in the state. And then in the 90s, NARA opened a health clinic, and then the years in 2000 really began to expand the mental health services and child and family services. And I think what the years of 2010 and beyond bring us are really all about healthcare reform and sort of opportunities to sort of expand our services throughout our organization. So we have a model of health, mental health, addictions, recovery, and culture is the model of our program. And we have 8 sites that we operate, residential treatment program for men, women, and their children. We have a transitional house for women and children. We have 2 clinic sites, one in northeast Portland, one in southeast Portland. We have child and family programs and adult outpatient program in sort of southwest Portland. And then we also have in east Portland a new facility, which is has a wellness center based on the South Central model. A lot of the design for it is. And then also our youth program, which you're going to hear a little bit more about. We serve, you know, 0 to 104 in ages, and we have programs and services throughout our organization. Our diabetes program, you know, has been honored and recognized nationally for the work that happens. I don't know if you all got a chance to see an article that just came out in the paper from, there was a PBS article that went out that talked about that, you know, diabetes is on the rise within the country, and that you know, success has been found in Indian country. And so what I would say is that we have a model for prevention. It's recognized throughout Indian country, throughout the United States, really. And in the 8 years that we've had this program operational, there's only been 4 people that have converted from pre-diabetes to diabetes. So I think we know what works in that area, and, you know, we're happy to share that. So we serve people, you know, Native people, but all people, anyone who wants to come to our programs and services. We had about 5,000 people who have come to us last year and throughout our services. And with the expansions that we've been doing, we anticipate more. We also have 4 other sites that we operate in. We have a project, a joint project with LifeWorks, where we provide health in their program. We provide alcohol and drug treatment for the youth at Christie Care, Youth Villages now. And we also have some work that we've been doing with the Chamawa Indian School with the kids there in leadership development. And we've also been working, you know, with DHS, actually, and we have one of our staff is outposted in their program to help with doing some of that early intervention work that y'all are talking about that's so important to prevent foster care placement and disruption of families. So we have really been working closely with them now for the last year or two around some of that work, and also work with Judge Waller in Multnomah County around it as well. So I think, you know, we have sort of a continuum of care to some extent. We sort of have a system of care. And for the last few years, we've really been working at, you know, trying to integrate that more fully. So again, if our model is health, mental health, recovery, and culture as part of our programs, then we're looking at how to do that. So some of the things that we're looking at in the next year are trying to figure out how to sort of take those programs that we have that know that work and expand them throughout our services. So I'd really like to ask Jerry Bruno to talk a little bit with you all about our youth program and the design there. We've been pretty blessed over the last few years in our growth and ability to serve more people in more better way. But part of that, the youth program is based on a grant through SAMHSA for suicide prevention that we do along with the 9 tribes of Oregon. And we also have a program for some other prevention work out of the Indian Health Service for meth and suicide prevention. So those are some of the aspects that come in. I just got to acknowledge that, you know, those are, we're moving our programs and all of our services from more of a pathology-based concept to wellness. So I know I need to talk about the issues so that you all know that they're there, but it's a language shift and a whole sort of paradigm shift that we're creating in our organization to move, you know, more to wellness. So anyway, I was going to say, here's Jerry.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jerry Bruno. I am the president of Bruno Training and Consulting. I grew up in Warm Springs. I'm a member of the tribe. And it's an honor to be here. I just want to share very quickly about the youth program that NARA has. And it's been an honor to be able to work with them because I've been doing this for about 30 years and I'm 21 and I'm sticking to my story. But I've been working with the youth in the sense of what culture is in regards to, thank you, in regards to our connection, what the youth connect to, what's their identity, how are they connecting as a young person today with all of these challenges that they have, all of the above. And so when we look at the youth program, we're looking at it from that perspective of principles, laws, and values that they may be coming from. Whether they're Native American or non-Native American, there's always a culture behind who they are. And so what we look at is that spiritual connection when we talk about languaging, what's that approach, what's their resiliency, and how do they connect to who they are. And so it's been kind of, for me, fun because youth is my passion. women. I love working with young people. And they've got, NARA's got the youth program working with Project Venture, which is science-based, and it's culture-based on strength, being strength-based, focusing on what they have within themselves from a spiritual perspective to their values to identity, especially at the ages that they're working from 0 to 104, always asking that question, where am I, who am I, and what am I going to be doing? And so we look at the Eric Erickson model, which is really based on his study from Northwest Tribes on over into Montana. And in that Eric Erickson model, what does that look like in their development? And so when we look at that, it's through their leadership programs, youth councils, which also address communities and families. They have a Thursday night that the whole community comes and joins for a meal, and then they also do an activity with the youth. And it's pretty exciting. It's growing. Every time I come into town, it's just, I mean, they have up to 100 people that join them on Thursday evenings. They finished a camp with Chimala. We did some work with them in regards to it's culturally based, experiential, adventure training, which gives young people an experience of seeing their own strengths as not always focusing on the negatives as much as focusing on their strengths, because they really know what's out there in regards to negativity. But culture has always been a strength-based, what you have within you, can we overcome this? Not saying that we're ignoring this the issues at all or not addressing them, but becoming solution-oriented and helping young people become solution-oriented to who they are and where do they want to go in life, and so that they can be, you know, a member in the community that's giving back. And so really that's what's exciting about NARA, because they are doing some things that are cutting edge. It's not the normal, you know, kinds of A&D work, although they have A&D counselors there that work with them, and their approach also is from a cultural perspective to mental health, and it's exciting to see that they have a studio where they can go and perform and make their own music. They have a young person on staff who does a lot of writing and poetry and use a lot of the arts with the young people. They have a computer room where they can have some tutoring done or some other kinds of things that they want to work on, and so they're really, it's kind of an open door where the young people can walk. Some of the young people that come in there are homeless and they're just looking for a meal. But what is exciting about NARA is that they engage them to take those next steps. What more can we do? And what other resources does NARA have to be able to help to address those resources for these young people? And so I'm really excited, because resiliency from that cultural perspective is kind of where we are in regards to, you know, growing up in Warm Springs, growing up very, very traditional, that resiliency is being able to go back to our spiritual ways. Not necessarily saying it's religious ways. It could be religion. It could be music. It could be meditation. It could be any of those kinds of things that help our young people to connect to who they are. So I just wanted to kind of keep that short, and I want to thank you for the time for today.
I had the opportunity to go through a couple of your clinics, and I think that CCOs could probably learn a lot about wellness, and I'm very impressed, especially with your work with the youth. And there's the Indian Native American population has a very high alcoholism, dropout rates, etc. And you're actually involving these youth in addressing some of these issues so they aren't lost in the system that we have right now. So that's why I'm impressed, and that's why I wanted you to present to this committee, so that that there are organizations out there that are truly looking at a wellness model that truly, I think, will help address some of the addiction problems that we have in this state. Mm-hmm. Senator Bates.
Just a couple things real quick. First, thanks for your good work.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. I always have a little trouble because I think of you as First Nations, as the Canadians do, and not Native Americans, so I'm just going to work on that, okay? I like First Nations. I like First Nations better, frankly, okay? I think you have a better approach. But you have biological and cultural issues that really put especially First Nations Indians at risk. How are you doing in reducing the suicide rate, which I know has been a huge problem? If my memory serves me correctly, we still have more Native Americans living off reservation than on, many of them attracted to the Portland area. And thirdly, area I have some concerns about is the Chilicon area. We have a large Native population there, and we still have some real serious problems. Do you have an outreach program there? Can you develop one down there? I know it's a long ways from Portland, but I spend a lot of time over there fishing, and I have some personal relationships over there that I'm still concerned about that population. It's one that's in poverty and struggling with alcohol and drug addictions. And I don't know what the suicide rate is there, but I know it's significant. What do you know about that? What can you tell me that you might be able to help in that area?
Thank you, Senator Bates. Well, I also understand that NARA has a specific suicide program, and so to address these kinds of issues. And the difference in all of this is that the culture, identifying them to that their inner identity, back to the land, back to songs, back to drumming, back to real basic values of building their leadership within themselves. And I say that in a way of self-esteem, helping them to see that they have a purpose in life from a different point of view, rather than, you know, let's just get you into some counseling, and not to say that's not important, it is absolutely, but it's an approach from going into a sweat lodge to where it's a spiritual beingness that we help them to remind themselves of who they are, and so the success in that is much higher. And you know, and I'll have to say from my own personal journey, I'm a survivor of suicide myself, and what got me out of that is why I'm doing the work I'm doing is because of culture. That is where one of my parts is, my heart is really dear and close to, in regards to how do we help them again see the importance of their life from a spiritual place. That culture is prevention, culture is integration, culture is treatment. And in that prevention, it's treatment, it's all of the above, that there's no separation, there's no go-to, it's not something to go to, it's a way of life. And that's the part of the suicide prevention, is that we're creating them a healthier, well life, body, mind, and spirit.
I think that as we, Senator, as we go forward, we're open to sort of talking with any communities about how we might help. I think, we're learning more and more about what works, and you're right about 68% of the Native populations throughout the United States live off reservation. And, we know that what Jerry's talking about works, that culture heals, and that if we're allowed an opportunity to do this long enough, that the effort is going to transform a community. So as you transform a child, a parent, an elder, it makes a difference throughout the community in terms of how they see themselves, how they feel about themselves, their worth, and their ability then to sort of go forward. And, as Jerry's talking about, your place in life, if you have a spiritual connection, how that changes and transforms people. So I think time sort of will show sort of the impact of the efforts that are going on. But we can see those efforts in the work that we do with kids every day, because we can see the changes that happen. Jerry just ran a Project Venture camp for some of our kids, and I got to see them leave on Monday, and then I got to go and to hear their talent show the night before. And I could see big changes in those kids, and they also then attended our conference. conference after that, another youth conference, and that was sustaining change in sort of how they felt about themselves, that they had mastery, and they felt good about who they were, and they felt a different sense of being and belonging in the world. So I know these things can work. I think we, you know, we're working on them, and, you know, we're going to transform the whole. You know, the exciting part is trying to figure out how do we do this within the whole organization. So how do we talk with some Dr. Bates about how we can talk to our physicians about, you know, how they can change their dialogue. So somebody comes in with diabetes, and so you start talking to them about body, mind, and spirit, and, you know, help get them referrals for the other parts of what's going on with them and help them feel good about who they are. Because at the root of all this, it's really where it lies. So, thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Thank you so very much. Very interesting, very powerful.
Yeah, thank you very much.
With that, I'd like to ask John Bartholomew and Mike McCormick up to talk about Alzheimer's disease prevention.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Alzheimer's Association Oregon Chapter. We provide education and support for people diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease and related dementias and their families and caregivers all across the state of Oregon. I will try to be really brief and cut to the main points. I think you all know that Alzheimer's disease is a devastating disease. And what you may not know is the impact across the state of Oregon, that there's over 76,000 people in the state living with Alzheimer's disease, which is approximately the same population as Bend. And by the year 2025, we expect that to rise to 110,000 Oregonians with Alzheimer's, which is like adding all of Clatsop County on top of that. This is a huge number. It's growing rapidly. It's actually growing faster than the rate of the aging population. And then you have to factor in the caregivers. That there's currently over 165,000 unpaid caregivers in this state, mostly family members. And the care that they provide is worth over $2 billion a year. But as a result, they have poor health outcomes to the tune of approximately $91 million a year due to the stresses of being a caregiver. And for the state, dementia costs the Medicaid system significantly more money than a person without dementia. So it's approximately 19 times as much for a similarly aged person on Medicaid with Alzheimer's disease or without Alzheimer's disease, 19 times as much cost. Some of that is the factor of providing long-term care services. Some of that is the fact that they cannot manage their comorbidities such as diabetes or high blood pressure. So with the growth of the number of people affected and the high personal and financial costs to the state, we realize a plan needs to be put in place. And a couple years ago, we put together a task force that included Senator Mona Sanderson, Representative Dembro, folks from DHS, for-profit companies, nonprofit partners, academia, OHSU, a whole gamut of folks, and it was co-chaired by a state employee, Jennifer Mead from DHS, and a private sector CEO, Jason Hess, CEO of Elite Care. So we knew that this needed to be a public-private nonprofit partnership if we're going to be able to deal with the magnitude of these issues. So after having work groups with expertise, doing 6 town hall meetings across the state, plus a 7th telephone town hall meeting that reached people from Brookings to Baker City, we heard a lot of the issues, which are we need to break the stigma, because the stigma prevents people from accessing resources or getting diagnosed. Healthcare professionals are not well informed either about the disease or about what resources exist in the community. Quality of care in the long-term care setting is inconsistent and needs to be improved. Access to doctors, other services, respite care needs to be improved. And people need help preventing a loved one from driving, but we also need access to good transportation options. And of course, there's a serious concern for the thousands of people living with dementia alone, and have, you know, nobody keeping an eye out for them. So we listened to all this feedback and we considered, what can we actually do that, you know, given the current budget constraints, but the resources we have, because we didn't want to have this sit on the shelf gathering dust. So you all should have a copy of the state plan that was provided to you. And on page 6 are the 5 goal areas, each with 2 recommendations underneath. And there's strategies underneath each one of these. Many of these are things that state government is only going to be, you know, a consulting partner on. Some of these state government needs to take the lead on. But very briefly, enhancing public awareness engagement, doing a public awareness campaign, getting a website created that's a one-stop shop for information. Optimizing care quality and efficiency, creating better quality standards and metrics for our long-term care settings, and making sure we have a dementia-capable licensed healthcare workforce. Protecting individuals with dementia, we have recommendation on guardianship training and a number of things for the safety and well-being of individuals with dementia, including expanding the gatekeeper program. We have access to quality care. Make sure that the people who are currently ending up at the state hospital because of difficult behavioral needs have other more community-based settings that work better for them and cost less. And making sure that people in the far-flung regions of the state have access to expert care and services. Then we also need to do a better job with our data so we know where we are and where we're going and how well we're doing. And we need to expand dementia research and participation in research happening here in Oregon. And this all dovetails with a national plan for Alzheimer's disease, which is going to be providing more resources for research, more resources for medical provider training, more resources for respite care, et cetera. So these are this is the plan. And the great news is we're already moving forward with implementing it. I've got a number of things on my plate. I'm working very well with DHS, and Mike will be able to talk about what they've got going on. And there will be a resolution sponsored by Senator Monis Anderson that will be in support of this state plan. So since I urge you to really take a look at it, read it through. And I'm happy to answer any questions after Mike has a chance.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike McCormick. I'm the Deputy Director for Aging and People with Disabilities. First of all, we'd like to applaud the efforts of the Alzheimer's Association in creation of the first ever Alzheimer's plan. It's a really good piece of work, and we're proud that we had representatives from our agency on that task force. We know that this is a very big priority area for DHS. We see it every day in our work. Back in July of 2008, we were losing access to memory care facilities very badly, and these individuals were being served in nursing facilities unnecessarily. We implemented a bold rate increase. At that time, we were serving approximately 1,100 individuals in memory care facilities, and today it's around 1,800, an increase of 63% in 5 years. The demand is there. Private pay, Medicaid continues to compete with the private pay market, which I hear anecdotally is about double the rate of what Medicaid pays, so we're fortunate that we have the access we do. Recently, we reassigned one FTE to focus solely on dementia policy. She's very talented and she's going to do a great job in that area. We're evaluating the plan and what is feasible as we're considering our budget for what we propose in next biennium's budget. Some of the things we can do without funding, like we're going to make it a priority to address the resource and education issues on the agency's ADRC website.
And ultimately, we're going to be partnering on the development of quality standards for dementia care and long-term care, development of a dementia-capable workforce, dementia training for guardians. We're going to have to deal with the Medicaid contract termination issue, exploring ways to fund the gatekeeper program, developing specialized capacity to serve individuals that are currently residing unnecessarily in the state hospital due to dementia diagnoses instead of mental health diagnoses, and working on what the coordinated data system looks like that partners with the Oregon Health Authority and how we collect data so that we can better serve this population. So those are my comments, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you this morning.
Thank you. I'm sure every one of us have dealt with either family members or friends who have dementia, and so I'm glad that we're in the baby steps of addressing that issue. Any comments, sir? Thank you very much, very much. Now, the last item on our agenda is Duke Shepherd going to talk to us about the early learning count, giving us an early learning council update.
Could be one end or the other.
Yeah. Pass.
Thank you. Education committee meets in this hearing room.
Thank you. They moved to another room.
I've got that to get to.
You know this stuff. So.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, Duke Shepherd from the governor's office. I've been the lead staff of the governor on the early learning work for the past year and a half, and I'll just provide you a quick update on what the Early Learning Council has been up to. House Bill 4165 passed last February, 26-4 in the Senate, 51-9 in the House. The key components were the elimination of the State Commission on Children and Families, the Oregon Commission for Child Care, and the designation of the Early Learning Council as the required state advisory body under the Head Start Act. So all of those structural pieces have happened, which allowed for moving all the programs and funding together and under one place, and the elimination of three bodies that were not connected together very well. Additionally, in order to require to comply with the Head Start Act, the Early Learning Council was expanded. That was in 4165. And so the new Early Learning Council members are listed in my testimony. I would note that while the Head Start Act is somewhat prescriptive in terms of agency representation and Head Start representation, it requires a representative of Head Start, but the governor chose to appoint people with multiple sort of touches on Head Start from Portland, St. Helens, the Grand Ronde Tribe, and Condon. So we have a much larger Early Learning Council now, but a very diverse representation of skills, experiences, and backgrounds. We have hired, at long last, so this may be the last time you see me on this topic, an Early Learning System Director. Her name is Jada Rupley. She couldn't be here this morning. She will be around here this afternoon. She comes to us from ESD 112 in Vancouver with many decades of experience in elementary education and early childhood, including Head Start, early intervention, and special education. As with expanding Early Learning Council, a Youth Development Council was created, and that will be named shortly. The director has been named. That's Iris Bell. And 4165 listed out several key deliverables to the legislature, mostly reports due September 30th. One key deliverable is not a report, though it is the pilot of a kindergarten readiness assessment. And so I've handed you a report from the kindergarten readiness work group. It's quite lengthy, but I can just give you the update. And Madam Chair, may I ask what kind of time constraints you want me to apply to my testimony?
You're fine.
We're fine now.
Okay.
We're fine.
I won't
waste your time. I'll say everything
I'd planned to say then. So the governor's office convened a kindergarten readiness assessment work group of experts in early childhood, folks from the Department of Education, superintendents, kindergarten teachers, and looked at what a kindergarten readiness assessment pilot could be. The idea here is to give teachers a tool to assess how children arrive, what skill sets they need, and be able to plan better for their kids in the class, and to give the state, you, a tool to assess how your investments are resulting in kindergarten readiness in communities around the state. So it's a look forward and look back. It is not an entry assessment. It does not let you in or out of kindergarten. It is just a checkup that everybody can use for the appropriate purpose.
So we had forums around the state, 7 community forums in Salem, Roseburg, Newport, Pendleton, Redmond, and 2 in Portland, with 350 people in total participating. So that includes parents, teachers, superintendents, early childhood educators. And we did 5 very specific focus groups, 1 of parents, superintendents, kindergarten teachers, early educators, and principals. And the key considerations for the assessment were that the data could be valid and reliable, that it would be appropriate for all children, that it would be useful to schools and teachers, provide meaningful feedback to communities, providers, and policymakers, and it would be efficient in terms of time and cost. And we wanted the assessment to cover the key developmental domains of social-emotional, self-regulation, approaches to learning, literacy, and math, and that would be something highly correlated with later high school later success, particularly third grade reading. So 16 schools and 13 districts have been selected for the pilot. They were selected through a lottery style process screened for both racial, ethnic diversity, income, and geographic diversity, and these were voluntary. So nobody's in the pilot that didn't want to be. And so the districts are Bethel, Coquille, Crook County, David Douglas, Greater Albany, Hermiston, Imbler, LeGrand, Portland Public, Roseburg, Salem, Kaiser, Sherwood, and Wallawa. And right now the training is underway with kindergarten teachers in these pilots so that the pilot can be undertaken in October, and the deadline for the pilot to occur is the end of October. After that, the Ford Family Foundation down in Roseburg has generously volunteered to pay for an assessment study that PSU will do to validate the assessment pilot, and then when it rolls out statewide next year, we'll have something that's been very well tested, very well validated, and hopefully is cheap, easy, and useful for everyone. And cost was a consideration. There are things you can buy off the shelf that are expensive, and there are others that get you what you need. And it should be noted that while the state has not had a kindergarten readiness assessment since 2009, many districts around the state had taken it upon themselves to develop or use different assessments, and so consideration was given to that too, so that we're not just wholesale throwing out things that might be working for districts. And so the pilot will reflect that, and we can have something to report to you in December, I would expect, about how the pilot went, though the validation study won't be done. And then I'll just touch on the reports that are due September 30th. They are not done, but they are all underway. So the Early Learning Council and the State Interagency Council, Coordinating Council for Early Intervention and Early Childhood Special Education, were directed to conduct a joint planning process around the unique complexities of early intervention and recommend some ways that those services could better be coordinated with other early childhood programs and efforts. And so that work group is underway. It's being staffed by the Council for Developmental Disabilities here at the state. And we'll have recommendations for September 30th. Another deliverable is an inventory of family resource manager functions around the state, and I'll just list for you the way we've broken down these functions based on job descriptions collected around the state. So there's a broker navigator function, there's the coordination of services, there's referral, there's focused relationship development with schools and preschools and pediatricians, there's advocacy, helping kids and families get what they need in different systems, there's assessment and intake, determining what people need and getting them into programs, and then there's family goal planning and skills training. So this assessment, using these skill sets and job descriptions, we've created a survey that's gone out to providers and stakeholders around the state. A list of the stakeholders that have responded so far are listed. So as of September 12th, we had 1,400 responses. So we should have, a very good sense of where these functions reside and how they're implemented across different communities around the state and in different programs, and we can begin to sort of pull the key components from there and figure out what works best where and how to replicate that and how to incentivize or reward the places where it works best. That will be a part of the challenge for 13, I expect. The Early Learning Council is required to submit by September 30th a comprehensive children's budget, which is really just grouping all of the early childhood programs and funding streams together as one into one place so we can see where we invest all this money in the state government. And I would give you the example right now, just the way the process works. You've got the Child Care Division's budget, because it's in the Employment Department, goes to one Ways and Means Subcommittee. The education stuff goes to another, and the health goes to another. There's rarely an opportunity for the legislature or the governor to see it all as one investment, and so that's what we are hopefully be able to bring to you and use as a starting point for a different kind of budgeting approach over time. Those are the deliverables for September 30th. A couple other things I will just touch on. One of the big deliverables for the next session is a new delivery system in communities. So the local commission system, local county commission system, expires June 30th of 13. And the Early Learning Council is charged with, this will sound familiar to all of you from CCO work, come back with criteria for an RFP. And so we've got a work group underway right now to deliver that criteria to you. It's due in February. We're going to try to get it to you in December. The criteria for communities to apply to be what are called in statute community-based coordinators of early learning services. We may come up with a better name, but right now the way I've thought about this, and I just need to emphasize that the only pieces that are known are what's in statute. That's what the work group, that's what the Early Learning Council is going to stick to. If it's in statute, that way everybody knows what we know in terms of what these things will look like. Just the way I've begun to talk about this, instead of focusing on who's going to administer what, it's really about a contract with a community that we in Oregon have never said communities we're going to all get. It's our job together to get kids ready for kindergarten, and it's a challenge that the RFP will be getting people to sign up for this challenge. And that's the easiest way to think about it. If that's the outcome, then the communities can come together and figure out how to best reach that outcome. That's obviously very complicated. I don't know enough about the CCO world to say what's more complicated or not, but one thing that is different is we aren't talking about one pool of money. There are many different funding streams, many different programs, so it is a particular challenge that will evolve somewhat differently. But process-wise, conceptually, it is very much set the outcome, challenge communities to come together, and hopefully get the results that we're looking for. Two last pieces, and then I won't take up any more of your time. We've had in statute for 11 years now requirements for universal screening across early childhood settings, and it's never occurred. So we've had a work group the Early Learning Council is considering today, and a report will be issued this week recommending a suite of assessment tools to be used across settings. Again, not reinventing the wheel here, but pulling the most well-recognized and professionally reviewed and best used screening tools to assess risk development and get those across the settings so we can have some consistency so that eventually we can determine what all the state's investments are really adding up to and where we can make better investments. And finally, the Child Care Division has been working on a tiered quality rating and improvement system for licensed child care centers, facilities, which is really it's a mechanism to assess and improve quality in child care, give parents some information about making choices, and has five components. There are standards, accountability measures, provider support, financial incentives, and consumer and parent education. And that didn't have a firm timeline. It was, as funds are available, initiate the development of in statute. However, we want to be aggressive about it. It was part of our Race to the Top application, which was not initially funded, but we feel confident we will get a funding in this. I guess it's fall now, so winter, to implement most of what was in our original application. And so that field test will begin in January. And with that, that's the work of the Early Learning Council.
Thank you very much. I do have just one. I know this is Early Learning Council. The teachers that I'm talking to are very concerned that they will be burdened with more assessment and with more assessment, all the other assessments that they have to do are not going to go away. And I felt I just needed to let you know that. I think you probably are already maybe aware of some of the concerns that are coming from the grassroots.
Madam Chair, we are. I think Dr. Crew is definitely working on that across the whole K-12 system, and that was a very key consideration about the kindergarten readiness assessment, that it be value-added and not some other test that that teachers are forced to do to check off some box, that it's something that they actually use that doesn't take long. I mean, we're talking minutes in terms of doing these assessments.
Senator Bates.
So Chip was first.
No, actually, I want to talk to you after the committee about a different topic, if you can stick around, dude.
Senator Bates.
Hey, thanks. Several of us attended all those long, hard meetings that went on forever last session. I'm not sure if I'm hearing this correctly, so maybe you can correct me. The key issue that I took away from, in a very simple way from those, was one, identifying children at risk prenatally or right after they're born, and really doing good identification on that, not just firstborns, but all the kids. And the second half of that was to give services to those families that we have identified prior to kindergarten. And the idea here was, I thought, that we're going to focus on ages 0 to 4 or 5. We're not going to focus as much on K through 12. The real issue is those kids come to kindergarten, first grade, they're not ready to learn for cultural reasons, educational reasons, family reasons, drug and alcohol, stress reasons in the family, all those things we talked about. And when I see a tool for kindergarten, I go, damage is already done, we're already there. We've seen how hard it is to change that after that age. Not impossible, but it gets harder and harder. And so I just kind of wonder, I didn't hear much about, you know, 0 through K age group. That's the key age group. That's the 40% dropout comes from. That's where the stress in the family prevents them from learning properly, all those, the science that we know about. So what's the council thinking about that 0 to 5, 0 to 6 age group?
So Senator Modest Anderson, Senator Bates, so in my effort to focus on the deliverables in the legislation, I skipped across the key part, which is the substance of what we're trying to do. So that really does, in terms of relating it back to the bill, though, that really does get to back to the delivery of services and changing up how we do things, and that comes back to reorganizing what we do in communities, and it gets back to the budget. And so the components that you've named remain the focus for the Early Learning Council. It really is early identification and then getting the services we need in place to better deliver them earlier for kids and more broadly to the highest risk kids that we know. So the kindergarten readiness assessment is a component that ties the early learning world to K-12 in a way we haven't. And an example I would give is that when I've gone to communities, I've had in rural and urban areas, the number of times I've had early childhood educators and kindergarten teachers say to me, this is the first time we've ever met, it's the first time we've ever talked, is notable. And it's important that we're bridging that gap. But you're right. The assessment just tells us partly what we already have the instinct for based on third grade reading scores. So the better community-based delivery of services is the biggest deliverable, and that's really the focus.
It's the hardest, too. One of the things we ran into is we had a very short discussion, trust me, it was short, about taking some K-12 money and investing it in the first 5 years of life. You know, that's what needs to happen. You know, it's a small investment there. That huge budget would make a huge difference, and our K-12 system would function at a higher level. We have higher graduation rates and better outcomes. Well, I'll tell you what, there's some political issues there, I'll tell you.
Thank you, Duke, very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity. Right. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, committee, and we will see you in December. With that, we adjourn.